It's not necessarily an early symptom. It goes with the symptoms of motor problems. So you get
micro calligraphy.
It does get smaller and smaller as your voice begins to go as well. So the pockets of people usually speak very quietly because they can't. So it's just a motor thing, I think.
I understand that some well-known authors, after their death, have had their papers examined and their handwriting has seemed to get smaller and smaller, even though they didn't die of Parkinson's.
Interesting. Yeah. Anyway, you die with Parkinson's, you don't die of Parkinson's.
Yeah.
You die of diseases of the immobile, so things like chest infections, because you know, for you or I, we can cough and get all the stuff out, but disease of the immobile that you have difficulty with, that sort of thing.
Else?
Yep. Would there be an advantage in treating people who are diagnosed by laboratory methods before the clinical symptoms occur?
So probably the only way to do it would be to do this PET scan. So not with the treatments we have at the moment. So the treatments we have at the moment are only dealing with the motor symptoms of the disease. So it's only worth treating those people once the motor symptoms have expressed themselves. Because you're not altering the progression of disease. Once we get drugs which can alter the progression of the disease, or procedures which can alter the progression of the disease, and we have early diagnosis, then there should be the option that you are going to get the disease, or you are on the pathway in 10 years, if your neurons continue to die, you're going to get the motor symptoms, which are going to inhibit your life. Therefore, taking this drug will prevent progression. There may be some argument, if we do end up with those therapies, of the people with the genetic forms of the disease as well, to offer it to them. Do you want other genetic forms, like Huntington's disease as well? If we can find something which prevents those neurons dying, which are dying in Huntington's, which are different ones, actually the neurons should be very beginning, they're the ones to go. Then yes, we should be offering it to people at that stage.
Will, at the back, and then over to the left.
Just touching on that slightly, I was wondering about the drug, the theory supposed to prevent, not the onset of Parkinson's, but the delay the onset of Parkinson's, things like that.
Okay, so there's a little bit of that. So the monoamine oxidase inhibitor, the drug which inhibits the enzyme, which breaks down dopamine, that has been claimed to have some neuroprotective effects. I don't know whether. So that's actually. I can't remember the exact details, but it will have been in cell cultures and probably in animals. To actually detect that in the human is very difficult. So yes, there is some effect there, but it's not prominent. But I think the main reason that those drugs work, that selegene works, and I can't remember the name of the other one. I can't remember its name, but. It works because it's inhibiting the breakdown of dopamine and dopamine staying around.
Well,
Right. We have a person who's works on dopamine and releases dopamine. Challenging question.
I'd like to ask. I know that dopamine does innervate several different areas of the brain, like the prefrontal cortex, dorsum, and ventral striatum. Do they all lose dopamine innervation at the same rate?
Great question. It's almost a planted question.
And are they responsible for different effects, different symptoms?
Okay. So his question is that I was just talking about. So Parkinson's disease is principally dopamine neurons of the substantia nigra, a particular part of the substantia nigra called the pars contacta. And there are lots of other groups of dopamine neurons in the brain. And the question is, are these other groups of dopamine neurons dying as well? And are they responsible for some of the symptoms? So I think probably, there's some evidence for it, it's not established, but I think probably that so we have our compactor neurons which die and give us the motor symptoms, and then you come to the middle of the brain, there's an area called the ventral tegmental area, projecting to different parts of the brain and actually to our cortex on the outside. And when those begin to die, I think you get the cognitive deficits of Parkinson's disease. That might not be the whole truth. But other sets of dopamine neurons begin to die as well. Other types of nerve cells in the brain die as well. So why is it that the neurons of the Parkinson factor are particularly sensitive? So this is almost the planted question, because I just wrote a commentary in movement disorders and we had a theoretical paper on it. So I think that neurons of the Parkinson factor are very sensitive to dying because they have, one of the factors is, because their axon is phenomenally large. So in a rat brain, the total length of the axon of an individual dopamine neuron can be up to 40 centimetres. So that's along here, all the branches, you count up all the branches. And in humans, that could be up to 4 metres. So every single one of these cells has, in humans, has an axon which is about 4 metres total length. And so my our hypothesis is that enormous axon, such a great question, puts an incredible energy demand on the neuron, such that, the way we describe it is that the neurons are on the edge, and anything that comes along, any factor like oxidative stress, like mitochondrial dysfunction, like environmental factors, it's going to tip these neurons over the balance because they have such a high energy demand, because of their complex axons. And then the reason that rats don't get Parkinson's disease and we do is because in humans, dopamine neurons have to do 10 times what they do in other animals. And then our hypothesis was based on a whole variety of things. And then we had a computational neuroscientist who made a computer model of the axon just to ask the question, what's the energy cost of sending one action potential throughout the axonal arm of a dopamine neuron? It turns out that it's super linear. It's more than it's not directly related to the size, but it's the size and complexity makes it even more energetically expensive. Mm-hmm. I haven't tested it experimentally, and I think that would be a 5-year project that might be past my sell by date. Oh, we tried to test it experimentally, but failed.
Let's go to the back and then the front table.
A friend of mine that's funnily enough on a cycle event, cycling from London to Paris, so it's obviously a good friend for cycling. He had brain surgery and a membrane put into his brain.
Membrane?
And drugs, it's research.
Yeah, yeah. Is that in Bristol?
Yes, it is Bristol. And okay. Every so often there are some drugs that are applied through that membrane.
Okay, so this is...
Which of the techniques...
So this is a trial going on in Bristol. Stephen Gill is the surgeon who's doing it. And you put in what's called a dialysis probe. So a dialysis probe is a probe which has this membrane around it through which some chemicals can get across the membrane. And they're putting the GDNF, this growth factor, into the brain and seeing whether... they put it in and it diffuses out into the brain and to see whether that promotes individual or the remaining dopamine neurons from sprouting axons, which there is evidence in animals that happens, sprouting the axons and then producing a better innervation of the region.
And why is the membrane approach more considered special interest rather than, you mentioned it was injection before?
Yeah.
Takes it out of the blood, don't get through the blood.
Yeah, so you couldn't inject it systemically into your arm here because it wouldn't get into the brain. And you need vast amounts of it, and this stuff is incredibly expensive. So you need to get it directly into the brain. You don't want to, if you're having to do over and over again continuous injections periodically, you don't want to be injecting things in the brain. So you put this thing in, and then you just pour, in effect, pour the stuff into the tube, and it diffuses out.
We've joked with them.
Actually, we can joke about that. Then you can joke with the people who have deep brain stimulation as well, because the problem there is that the batteries only last about 2 years. And every 2 years, they have to go in and get their batteries checked. They can't move until they get their batteries checked.
Okay. Okay. Let's call the first one.
A lot of elderly gentlemen have
no,
rather elderly gentleman had slight tremors.
Yeah.
My brother has this. Is that indicative of the
No, because there are all sorts of tremors. There are all sorts of forms of tremor. And there's a thing called essential tremor, which we don't know what's causing it. It's probably related to the thalamus. And it probably actually with age as well, you begin to tremor more. So it's not necessarily so. So look at your friend. Just see how they're walking. You know, are they walking like this? Or are they walking like this? And look at the facial expressions. If that's going along, if that's in addition to the
it should be there as well.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I only know of men get it. Do women get it?
Yes.
Do men get it more than women?
It's more common in men than women. It's so only slightly more.
Any reason
common.
For that? Do you think?
I have no idea. Thank you.
You mentioned the enormous length of the
axon
in the humans. Does this really suggest that, first of all, it must be very tightly coiled up?
Not tightly coiled up. So what happens with an axon when the axon goes into? So this is, so in ours we have the dopamine neuron here, probably a few centimeters, and then it branches and branches and branches and branches. Thousands and thousands of times. And then the branches from this one will overlap the branches from another one. And it produces an incredibly dense field of axon terminals coming from the neurons.
So would this suggest that there's a limit to really in the development of human brains, that they get too big, and they're bigger than animal brains, that we're not able to indefinitely increase our intelligence, for example?
So I always think of it in evolutionary terms and breeding. So we've developed these dopamine neurons, and you know, dopamine neurons are involved in all sorts of things. You know, the pleasure response, the alcohol, the buzz, smoking a cigarette, the buzz, the excitement of riding on your scooter, and going over that fantastic bridge on your scooter would be just most amazing thing. But what's happened is that we live too long. We live past our sell by date. I've produced children, and I've produced grandchildren, and you know, in evolutionary terms, I've done my bit. So it doesn't really matter that the dopamine neurons are probably too big, too complicated in evolutionary terms, I think. So is there a limit to what we can do? Yeah, I guess. It would be nice if it wasn't.
Thinking of dopamine, you mentioned that one could measure the activity by a test.
Expensive.
Is any work being done on a much cheaper way of tracking dopamine levels?
Well, I could hand over to my colleague here, who works on animals, and he's using a really cool technique in animals to measure dopamine release. Do you want to mention that?
Well,
I'll put you on the spot now.
Have a little bit. Well, I work on a technique in mice, which is called in vivo psychophotometry, which basically uses an electrode placed at a point where dopamine is produced in the striatum to actually measure the amount of dopamine that gets released, so the concentration that you find there in the striatum. It's obviously quite a bit more invasive than something like PET scanning, which is why we don't use it in humans.
There are many techniques of measuring dopamine which are good in animals, but not in us. But what many people are doing is, and what the Oxford Parkinson Centre is looking for, what we call biomarkers. The ideal would be to take a blood sample from you and then look for a molecule in there which has changed its level in relation to Parkinson's. And we actually, the volunteers in the Parkinson's, in our clinical cohort, I'm one of the controls, we've given blood samples, we've given cerebrospinal fluid as well, so we can look for it in there. And there's nothing close on the horizon at the moment, but that is the aim, that we can diagnose Parkinson's early from a biomarker which is
before I hand over, just to say to you, Paul, that the 500 strong mailing list of this cafe loves being volunteers and things. So if you ever need any volunteers at virtually any age, you probably we should bustle some up. We've got a lot of people taking part in exploring.
First of all, thank you very much. This was absolutely fascinating. I'd actually completely forgotten about this, but I took part in a study, and only when you mentioned biomarkers just now, where you record a sample of your voice, and healthy volunteers, presumably people with Parkinson's, different ages.
Yeah.
So I filled out a form online, which said, you know, give us some basic sort of demographic data, which part of the world, age, gender, all of that. And then you have to call a particular number and record a voice sample in your normal voice. And the idea was that they'd build up a database and look for, you know, hints of tremors in the voice and try and analyze it.
Yeah.
Do you know any more about that?
Yes.
Because
so
I wanted to find out more and I never did.
Yes, so that, again, I can't remember the name of the guy who's doing it. But that research is still going on. And in our new proposal for the next 5 years of the Oxford Parkinson's Disease Centre, it will be an aspect of it. Simply talking into a phone, you do some algorithm with the analysis of the voice, and you can separate out people with Parkinson's and people not with Parkinson's. And that's because speech is a motor activity, and you know the speech is a very and rich output of muscles, unlike you know just doing that. So it may be that in the future we can diagnose it that way, and it may be a biomarker that we can then look at the progression of the disease in an individual.
What about doing motor skills tests, you know, with your hands?
Yeah, so in the test the neurologists do the motor skill tests. There are all sorts of mostly motor skill tests, but then you know, cognitive and memory and all that stuff.
You mentioned smokers not being so affected by it.
Yeah.
What happens if people wear nicotine patches?
I don't think that's a good study.
They're relatively new, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's in general use.
It's quite difficult to get people. It's difficult to get fun being to study that sort of thing in this day and age. So.
Well, it's better to have a nicotine patch as a normal one.
But if you know, the lab that you're in is very interested in the effects of nicotine on dopamine release, or there are other people doing it, but to look at the incidence of Parkinson's disease in people who are using patches, I don't know about it. I don't think it hasn't been done. It's quite a complicated thing to do, and a very expensive thing to do. But you might have a good experiment.
And then they don't treat people with Parkinson's with
nicotine agonists, do they? I don't think so. No, I don't think that's good. I don't think it's that good.
Is it possible to have a dopamine neuron survive kind of on its own or in some tissue that you know not bombed up with lots of the neurons? In other words, can you kind of isolation study what makes it die? Because you know, does it die like a normal aging cell, or does it die through some other mechanism? Could that a way in maybe to
So if you can grow nerve cells in culture, primary nerve cells in culture, the nerve cells you take from the brain and grow them in culture. You can grow dopamine neurons in culture. Of course, if you think about my hypothesis, when you dissociate a brain, you break that off, so it'll be gone. And you know, that's where most of the neuroprotective therapies are tested first, in those sort of situations where you have dopamine neurons in a dish. You apply an insult to them, whether it's oxidative stress or there's some very specific molecules which affect dopamine neurons and kill them and test those, or you can take the more general ones. So yes, you can do it in a dish, and yes, they do grow. But it's been a big failure, unfortunately. It's been a big failure. So you can get compounds which will be neuroprotective in the dish, and then will be neuroprotective in animals, where you induce Parkinson's disease by killing dopamine neurons. And you get some neuroprotection, and then you have to take it to the clinic and do a clinical trial. And then it becomes very complicated and very expensive. And if you're only seeing it's only a very tiny effect, say, over the
time scale of the trial, you know, if it's 2 years or something, it's very difficult to see. And nothing has come through in that pathway. And I think drug companies are quite frustrated and irritated by the money they put in and what's coming from the States. But I hope, let's hope.
Drug companies are in the news at the moment. Anyway.
Yes.
What about the other end of that? So, is there any knowledge about whether when a dopamine neuron is dying through Parkinson's, whether it's dying normally or whether there's something particular that's happening to it?
Well, as I said, so you're talking about apoptosis,
yes,
which is a normal program cell death. So I don't think it's probably not apoptosis, but there are some evidence that it may be apoptosis. But then there is, as I pointed out, there's mitochondrial dysfunction, mm-hmm, there's oxidative stress there, there's other inflammation going on there. So there are many factors which I think are coming together to cause it to die.
Yeah.
And again, it's quite a difficult thing to do in humans with Parkinson's disease, because you have to work on post-mortem tissue.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, it should be fresh, but it's not, it's frozen.
And I mean, there's some remarkable things that you can persuade cells to take up. Is it possible to persuade a cell to take in new functioning mitochondria or not?
No idea. Sounds like a good idea.
Because let's face it, that probably is easier than trying to tackle the genes.
Yeah,
I mean, mitochondrial therapy, if you like, might be.
Yeah, so some drug which promotes mitochondrial function would be good.
Mm-hmm.
Would be good, a good thing to try.
Kind of make the mitochondria first.
Yeah, but you can maybe promote the mitochondria that you have left in your remaining dopamine neurons, so prevent them, so that they have a ton of energy, so that they then don't die.
Well,
is there a factor of dopamine also contributory factor in motor neuron disease?
Dopamine, nothing to do with it. Absolutely nothing to do with motor neuron disease.
Okay.
So. Actually, those neurons use other chemical classes are coding, but it's a completely different system.
Right.
Completely unrelated.
Yeah. Fine.
How risky a process is deep brain stimulation?
Well, any surgery is risky. Poking something into your brain is risky. When I was first introduced, I thought, no way, if I was good at it. And I know several neurosurgeons, I thought, no way would I let them put something into my brain. But, as I say, there's probably 80 or 100,000 people who have been treated worldwide with this type of approach. I don't know what the mortality rate is. I think it's very low. So probably the major risk is infection or hemorrhage. Doesn't seem to be the case. There was one of the approaches was to make a lesion in the region where they put the probe for deep brain stimulation, and that was close to, I can't remember what the region was, but if you made the lesion there, you'd get it just slightly wrong, and then you could cause all sorts of other problems. But it's an incredible technique, because the electrode that you put in is aiming at something the size of a peanut. You've got to get it in the right part of the peanut to produce the effect. So that's an incredible skill.
And certainly somebody in Oxford, I think, is one of the main workers in this.
Yeah, Tipu Aziz. So Tipu Aziz was at the very beginning of that field. He was in Manchester working with the group run by Alan Crossman in Manchester. So it was his group. There was a group that's now at Emory. They were then at John Hopkins University. Then there was a group in Lyon. And when all these discoveries were made about what was going wrong, this overactivity, then the three groups were working in parallel, and then within months of it being done in monkeys, it was then done in humans. And Tipu still does have, you know, there's a big functional neurosurgery unit here at Oxford.
How long has it been going on for?
I think it was like 1991 was the first time, so it's over 20 years now. You could be, when I go to Parkinson's groups, you can recognise somebody who goes, because it's usually men, and they usually have baldy hair, and you can see the wire there.
Thanks for what's activating me for the moment, because I think it might be much more cosmetically satisfactory to get into the brain through the ear canal rather than digging from the top.
Yeah. You have to go past all the stuff, don't you?
Yeah. We don't have to go very far in.
I know, but to hit that peanut is incredibly difficult.
And so you want a stiff rod.
So what some people do, some surgeons do, is they put in an electrode like the one we were using to record that dopamine. And they put it in, and as it's going through, you're recording electrical activity. And then you know where you are by the electrical signal of the neurons. Right. So then you get to where the nigra is, and then you take this out, and then you put the stimulating electrode in. Yeah.
Going through here...
No, because you have to go through the... I can't hear what you're saying.
It just seemed a bit long to be going from the top of the head down towards the base of the brain. There might be a shorter part.
The nose?
That way, probably the shortest.
But yeah, you do. You still want to be able to move your head.
Any other contributions?
I was fascinated by the differences that you showed when the guy hopped on his bike and he cycled away as he did as well. I was wondering, what's the main differences between those two? Why are those two different types of music movements? What are they?
We don't know why that is. So clearly, the cycling is not going through this. Not using those pathways, and if the basic idea is selecting, is action selecting which movement you can do, then you don't need it to do that. Going straight from the motor cortex, involving the cerebellum.
How would you train somebody to use the other part of the brain?
It's not sequential, it's constant. Interesting.
Guys, can we have a bit of quiet, just the last bit?
But motor neuron Parkinson's, I've got the three thoroughly confused now.
Parkinson's is the one you want to get.
Well, thinking in motor neuron terms, it's the feet that go early on, and then muscle control weakens or progressively up the body. So it comes to the arms last, and the balancing movements in late motor neuron disease would be with the arms rather than as heretofore with the feet.
And then you're dying because you're not breathing properly.
You could be doing it after the feet have gone, and the legs have gone.
Yeah.
So you stop running and start cycling.
It sounds as if everyone else chat, which is absolutely fine. So we're going to wind it up there. So I need to say my thanks, obviously, to the museum for letting us be in here, to our sponsors, Oxford Bioscience Network, who are very devoted, to my lovely journalist helpers, who've been doing it and about to wash up and clear up. We don't need any help. We're a very slick operation, so just kind of, we're going to take a while to get out of here, so feel free to chatter a bit while we're going. If you haven't joined our mailing list, then please do so. If I haven't managed to get your flyers out, come and grab me and I'll give you the address of how to do it. It's an automatic one. Next month's not entirely sorted, but it's expecting to be something mathematical. There's a very brilliant visiting lecturer at my college that I want to capture, and I'm going to try and pin her down to that date. I will get the website update. I'm also going to put up talks from the last few months. What else have I forgotten? Anthony's slips are on the back wall there. Also out, now this is not related, obviously a completely separate disease, but we did have a talk about Alzheimer's back in January, and we had something come from an organisation which is particularly helpful to those who have Alzheimer's, because it offers a way to manage the problems of daily life. Both my relative and also one of Paul's have been using that tactic. It's working brilliantly. So I've actually left their brochures out, Content to Dementia, just on the table behind the wall. Highly, highly recommend it to anyone who has that problem. I knew people might be interested in both tonight. Other than that, thank you very much for coming. It's always made by the people, so thank you very much. And can we see more?